All right, well, last week we finished up the prospering of Jacob, and we ended the chapter 30 with this final verse here. So the man became exceedingly prosperous and had large flocks and female and male servants and camels and donkeys. So we realize that God had prospered Jacob and had given him now a herds and so forth for to support his family. And now we move into the kind of final aspect here of God's promises way back in chapter 28, and that is the journey home. So in these chapters 31 through 33, we're going to begin to see the journey of Jacob back to the promised land, or back to Canaan. So you recall back in chapter 28, what did God say? Go, I'll be with you. And what was one of the key things he said he would do? He would bring him back to the land in the process. Now, as we get into these chapters, kind of a couple opening thoughts. We're going to start to encounter larger blocks of text and narrative that are recording single events. So chapter 31, we're going to see what I call the exodus from Haran back to the promised land. And then in chapters 32 and 33, we're going to see this reunion with Esau in two chapters. There are really some wonderful implications in these chapters, but the one that just jumps off the pages to me, and the more significant, is instruction for living in the will of God. Right? Now, we all worry and struggle about this from time to time. How do we know that we're in God's will? Well, in this section, we get a terrific little four-part explanation of how we can know that with certainty. And we're going to have four C's. We know that anytime I do anything, we have to alliterate it. And there's got to be letters, okay? So they're kind of four C's. The first is it starts with conviction. So if you look back at chapter 30 and verses 25 and 26, the thing that kicks this off is it says, "Now it came about when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, 'Send me away that I may go to my own place and to my own country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me depart, for you yourself know my service which I have rendered you.'" So the first thing that we should look for in terms of understanding and discerning God's will is a sense of conviction about something in our life. Now, this will often come about in the form of some kind of desire that we have. So as you feel various different desires, and as they map up against biblical truth, this is kind of the starting point. So Jacob had this conviction about wanting to go back and return to his home. It continues, as we're going to get here into chapter 31, with your circumstances, okay? So God indeed works through circumstances in our lives. And in chapter 31, in verses 1 and 2, we're going to see both the change in attitude from Laban and from his sons towards Jacob. So he's had a conviction. He wants to return to the land. And this conviction seems to be getting some support with the circumstances that are occurring around him in his life. So kind of conviction, step one, circumstances, step two. Then what he does is he waits for confirmation. Okay, so he gets it pretty quickly here, and he gets it pretty vividly. Don't come to me next week and say, "God told you to go do X, Y, Z." Okay, if he told you, show me where you found it in here as supporting evidence. Okay, the Spirit can certainly direct us to scriptures. But what we see here is that he had a sense of conviction. He certainly had supporting circumstances, but yet he waited for confirmation, which God gave him in very direct and vivid terms here, and very quickly in verse 3. Now, what do you think the fourth one is? These are kind of the big three. What would be the fourth thing that you would think about in terms of making sure that you're in God's will? So we've had conviction, circumstances are supporting it, we've had confirmation. What do we have to do next?
Wait.
Huh?
Wait.
You need to see, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. Yeah, you got a C word. I couldn't come up with that one. I had a different one. Exactly right. You got to do it, right? Conclude it, or I said consummate it. Okay? So the fact of the matter is that oftentimes we have had a very clear sense of something that God is asking us to do in our lives, and we end up falling short of being fully in his will by our reluctance to take the step. Now, the step may be a step of faith, okay? We've waited. We've had confirmation. Now, today, confirmation, what would confirmation look like for us today? I mean, yeah, confirmation look like for us today? I mean, how would you look for confirmation in your lives for something you think that you have conviction and circumstances supporting?
Pizza in your heart.
Would you say pizza in your heart? I know you said peace. I just couldn't resist. Yeah, some sense of peace in your heart. Okay, so a sense of kind of settledness and so forth. What are some other ways that we might do?
You could say blessing.
Yeah, blessing. How would you, in what sense would you say there, David?
If you know that you're there, I mean, blessings in doing it come.
Okay, kind of what you anticipate might be the blessings coming out of that. Roger, you had your hand up?
God works with hailers, people who come to you and will tell you something that's going on in your life.
Right.
And that this is what they believe is good for you.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the key one. That's the one I was thinking about. I mean, you know, we're not likely going to have these kind of experiences where God's audibly speaking to us, okay? So that, could he do it? Sure. Is it normative today? Probably not, okay? But we do have other godly men and women around us in our lives, right? So do you have confirmation from people around you that would say, you know, yeah, I've heard what you've done, and you go to those kind of people, and you ask for their discernment as you look at various different things. And then, of course, once you've got all that, we do take this final step, which is the old Nike thing, which is just do it, right? I mean, we sometimes labor over decisions when it's blatantly obvious that God wants us to do it. And when we don't, we miss out, okay? So, you know, I love this statement back in Ezra. So turn back to Ezra in the Old Testament, or not back, forward in the Old Testament, since we're still there. So Ezra, okay, King's Chronicles, Ezra chapter 7, in verse 10, Ezra talks about kind of his conviction of what he wanted to do, and he says this, "For Ezra had set his heart to study the law of the Lord and to practice it and to teach his statutes and ordinances in Israel." So he set his heart to study it, but what's the other important thing that he did? Practice it or do it. Okay? So the sense is that we look through these things, and I think we see a great example of this from Jacob as we progress through these chapters 31, 32, and 33. We see him having an initial conviction. We see him looking at the circumstances in life, we have this confirmation, and then we're going to see how he goes through the process of consummating it as we move through chapter 31. The journey home is going to force Jacob to confront two lingering fears, right, and lean solely on God, and that was, of course, the wrath of Laban, and then ultimately the wrath of Esau, which he's going to be surprised about. So here's how the sections are structured. Chapter 31 deals with the Exodus. And I think it kind of proceeds in three broad parts. The first is verses 1 to 21, when we have his flight from Laban. And then in 22 to 42, we have Laban's pursuit and confrontation with Jacob. And then in verses 43 to 55, Laban ultimately releases Jacob to return to the land. Then in 32 and 33, we have the reunion with Esau. And it has two big parts. Kind of chapter 32 deals with the preparation, and it's quite the preparation, right? And initially, and indeed, not only his prayers and wrestling with God, but his whole plan. So 32 is kind of this interesting schizophrenia of Jacob, right? He goes back and forth between relying on God and prayer, and then, oops, let's come up with a plan, then prayer, and then plan, and then prayer, and then plan, and then ultimately God steps in and says, okay, we're going to do it this way, okay? So we see kind of this back and forth in this struggle with faith in his life. And then, of course, in chapter 33, from Jacob's perspective anyway, right, a rather unexpected reunion. So we see some movement between the brothers. Now, the verses record the galvanization of Jacob's return. And it's an interesting account that proceeds in six stages. Okay, so there's kind of six stages. Stage one, Jacob does a situational analysis in verses 1 and 2. Stage 2, God intervenes and gives Jacob some very explicit confirmation and direction. Stage 3, he has a family conference. And this is kind of interesting, right? Because up till now, he's been kind of bossed around by the ladies. Now he's kind of going to get the ladies involved in the decision process here. Stage four is kind of interesting, verses 10 to 13. We're going to have to figure out what's going on. It is revelation from God, but it's kind of an interesting, you know, in terms of how it fits in the narrative here. Stage five, he turns to the gals for their decision, and united they decide to stand. And then in stage six, the caravan departs. Okay, so kind of six steps as he's going through this first part. So somebody read verses 1 and 2 for me from chapter 31.
And Jacob heard the word of God and his son, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what belonged to our father, he had made all this wealth. Jacob saw the attitude of Adam, and behold, it was not turning toward him as formerly.
Okay, so we ended with this report of the extent of his prosperity, not only large flocks, but servants, camels, and donkeys. And as prosperity will do, right, it doesn't escape the attention of others. So, you know, everybody says, oh, if I just had a little more money, I'd be just fine. No, you just have a different bucket of problems, okay? You'd be fine maybe, but you'll have a different bucket of problems. And specifically here, that of Laban's sons and Laban himself, right? Reminding us that jealousy and greed are powerful and prevalent emotions, right? Greed and jealousy. Now, as is also the case, the early manifestation and jealousy of greed is what? All the murmuring, all the chitter-chatter that starts to go on. So, two things are wrong with the son's complaints. What are the two things that are wrong with their complaints? What have they gotten wrong?
He hasn't taken anything.
Absolutely right. He's taken them away. That's number one. He hasn't taken a thing. What else? Huh? Okay, so they suggest that Jacob has illicitly acquired the property, right? He's taken it away. He hasn't taken anything away. And secondly, they suggest that Jacob owes it all to Laban. He's made all his wealth from our father. Now, if you remember the preceding chapters, Jacob has been very, very careful not to take a thing, right? He hasn't taken that bait any of the times that Laban gave it to him. So now we have this sense of here. Now, what else do we learn about the nature of jealousy from the sons? Kind of what's one of the outcomes of jealousy? What does jealousy do to us?
Stirs us up.
Stirs us up, no question about that, right? But it also does something else to us. Bingo, absolutely. It distorts reality, right? You know, when you're jealous, you're not rational. You get the thing all spun up in your head. Well, no, this is how it really is. No, it isn't. It's just your sin of jealousy and what's going on in your heart. Now, Jacob heard the brothers grumbling, and next he what? Sees that the face of Laban, literally, the word friendly is supplied, is not toward him. Okay, so Mr. Bonamy, right? Oh, happy Laban, okay? All of a sudden was not too excited by Jacob's prosperity. So he saw that the face of Laban was not toward him as formerly. Okay, so he's done a pretty good situational analysis. The simple thing is that, okay, things have changed. Okay, my prosperity has brought a change. So I guess Laban is the Old Testament Cinderella, right? He's the Cinderella of the Old Testament. So Jacob was able to observe that Laban's attitude toward him had changed from one of camaraderie to potentially adversarial. Okay, so remember, he'd had the conviction. He got persuaded for six more years to stay and build his own flocks. And now that he's had God prosper him in that regard, he's got a significant change in his circumstances. Yeah, Ken.
Don't you think, though, really it was misperceived from the beginning? I mean, Laban shows up with nothing.
Right.
And, Jacob shows up with nothing.
Right.
Laban manipulates the situation right from the very beginning. Was
absolutely
he ever really friendly?
No.
You know, and so, yeah, he perceives that he's not
as friendly as I would say, I don't think he was all that friendly.
Yeah, right. I mean, and I would agree with that. I mean, but the fact is that there was at least some sense of harmony as long as he was doing what Laban wanted.
As long as he was working his rear
end off. Right, and making Laban grow and do better. Right. So, yeah, was there ever a real genuineness in that? No, of course not.
In the previous deal, too, Laban thought he would be the one to come out ahead with the spotted sheep and the pure sheep.
The spotted and the speckled.
He thought that, you know, the odds were in his favor.
Right.
So now, all of a sudden, not so much, and his temperament changes.
Yeah, so how did that happen, I wonder? Not so much, right? We had our genetics lesson last week, right? And we figured out he only got a 25% chance. Yet all of a sudden looks like he's getting the better odds all of a sudden in the deal. Hold on to that thought, because that'll be the answer to a question coming up. All right, so Jacob had the initial conviction to return back in 32. The circumstances following his prosperity served to put him on alert. Okay, so he's reasonably thinking his way through it. And look, I do think circumstances are important, okay? I want to caution us not to play the fleece game, right? I don't think that's a very safe thing to do. But things are going on around us, right? And if we believe that God is provident, that means we believe that God is bringing things about in the course of our day-to-day lives. And as we look at things that are happening around us, we should be thinking and asking, okay, what's going on? So he patiently awaits for confirmation, which comes in verse 3 from God himself. So somebody read verse 3 for me.
Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you.
Okay. You got to love God, right? He's a man of little words, but he says a lot in a little bit, okay? So what is so striking about God's intervention? What's the first thing that ought to come to our mind as we read this little verse?
God spoke.
Yeah, okay, but what about his speaking?
Timing.
It's been 20 years, okay? He hadn't heard anything from God in 20 years. Now, he had this very powerful thing back in chapter 28, but it's been 20 years, okay? And this is the first time God has spoken to him in these 20 years. So that's kind of the first thing that jumps out at us. Why does God need to intervene at all? I mean, Jacob's kind of, he sees the tea leaves. He sees what he needs to do. He's got the right idea, but why does God need to intervene? Yeah, there's confirmation. That's right, because we have that as one of our three C's. But what else? Why else might he intervene in this particular way?
It's his divine plan, and he's reminding Jacob that he's holding it up.
Okay. Jim, you have we're going
to? I wasn't here for the previous lesson, but I...
So we'll only take half off if you're wrong.
Well, I noticed that he had tried to leave before.
Right.
Laban told him, hey, you know, God told him by divination that I've been blessed because of you.
Right.
He convinced him to stay.
Right.
By name your wages and I'll pay them.
Yeah.
He'd already made a deal with it.
Right.
So, because God hadn't spoken to him the first time when he wanted to leave.
Right.
He made a deal, and if he stayed, he thought, well, you know, the propensity humanly speaking is if he came back and made another deal, said, well, if you'll stay, I'll give you some more stuff.
Okay.
He might have been tempted to stay.
You know, okay, well, just you're on the right track here, okay? But here's the last step in that. He's gotten comfortable, okay? And he has become complacent, right? So everything you said, that's all the lead up, right? There's been more deals, lots of kids, now lots of flocks. Hey, seems like a pretty good place to live. Jacob had probably grown comfortable in the process, right? He's got a big family, prosperous rancher, many servants. In short, life is good, right?
Proverbial push.
Yeah, okay. Now you're coming up to the next kind of thing. So Jacob had the right idea, but he didn't follow through. So what are some of the powerful spiritual lessons? Go ahead, David. You get the proverbial push. Okay. Yeah.
And oftentimes, God brings in tension and problems to get our attention back to what he wants to do.
Absolutely.
He was totally frustrated with Laban and his sons. He really felt very uncomfortable, and God says, okay, get on your knees, and I'll use this opportunity to talk to you. You're going to listen to me now.
Yeah, absolutely. So you guys are nailing all. But sometimes God needs to kick us out of our comfort zone to induce growth, right? we are so ready to say, oh, good, got it covered, all done, right? Right? No, because if you stay too long in a place you don't belong, what happens? It starts to feel like home. I mean, this is how sin gets a hold of us, right? You take that step, you know, and it's just a slippery slope. No matter what you say, as you take those steps, you're exposing yourself to becoming comfortable. Oh, well, it's not that bad. Oh, it's okay. You know, and you just see it. We see it in the church today, right? I mean, this idea that we have to make the Bible relevant is wrong from the starting point, right? Bonhoeffer's got a little statement in one of his chapters, what's the guy's name? The Greek guy that wrote the Metaxas, right? Has one of the chapter little headings is that, you know, the Bible doesn't need to be relevant. Its relevancy is axiomatic. I mean, axiomatically, it's relevant, okay? We're the ones that are irrelevant, right? But yet we have to, what do we have to twist this thing for? You know, and when you think about it, look, I don't want to put MacArthur on the pulpit all the time or on the pedestal, but the one thing that I admire about the man is he's just faithfully stuck to the word. He doesn't defend it. He doesn't argue it. He just preaches it, right? And I think that is really what is probably the strongest thing for a church to hold on to. And if you stay on the word and you stay on that plumb line, then I think you're a church that God can bless. He can have confidence that he can send people to. But you don't get in trouble when you're going down that path, right? So you stay there. So we stay too long, which is why we should live like sojourners, right? Doesn't the Bible constantly tell us we're just pilgrims, we're just passing through, don't get too attached to stuff. Doesn't mean we can't enjoy stuff. It just says don't let it rule in your heart and recognize that our journey is not complete until God calls us home. This is the part I get fussy with. It's like, oh, great, I'm all sanctified now. Nope. Let's take the next step, knucklehead. Right? So the whole fact of the matter is God is working on us to the moment he takes us home. Right? We're constantly being transformed into the image of Christ. And it's a joy. I've got to say, I know in my working career, the thing that used to drive me crazy is I would go for a certain time. I did startups, and you know, they kind of have the same pattern. And I'd go through the process, and you know, within 3 or 4 years, I was bored. I was like, man, okay, well, what do you do now? Oh, I'll go do another one. Oh, that's smart. So what do? You go in there, and it's kind of fun for the first 2 or 3 years. You figure it out. You get it going. And then guess what? 3 or 4, you're bored again. Okay? The fact of the matter of this and being sanctified and pursuing this kind of life, I can honestly tell you, I have not gotten bored yet. And it's wonderful. I mean, to me, it's the greatest thing to get up in the morning about. I have no hesitation about what I'm going to do the next day. And that is, some way he's going to smack me around a little bit more, and I'm going to learn something else, and it's going to be cool, because there's never any shortage of the things that we can learn in this process of sanctification. So he's always working on us. We don't get comfortable. We don't get complacent. We don't have to run around like we're sitting on prickly needles or anything, but by the same token, we should be welcoming that process into our life. Okay, all of which means if you find yourself in an uncomfortable circumstance, you might consider that God is nudging you and there's something he wants you to figure out. So the simplest thing to do at that point in time is simply pray and say, what is it? Okay, don't fight it, because the needles are just going to get longer and sharper, and maybe there'll be a few barbs on some of them. Okay, yeah.
I think of another C about contentment there too, since we're on the seas. It's interesting because you know as far as your sanctification, then at that same time, is it a time where you're supposed to be content in your circumstance? And I guess it's just asking God for wisdom during those times, like, what are you doing? And I think that those confusing times where, you know, everything around you is breaking loose, it's the best times, because you have no control, which is right. The best time to just, Lord, here I am.
You're perfect. You're loaded with those C words, aren't you? Content, control, you're good. But, you know, I got to tell you, I originally had the word content in here, and my dear wife said, that's not the right word. And she was right, because we are called to be content, right? Be content with what you have and where you are. So contentment at some level is indeed exactly what you said, right? There, we should be content in certain things. Mm-hmm. So it really isn't the contentment here. It's the comfort, right? And it's that you're there, right? And you want to do that. So it's a good point. So what is the content of God's message to Jacob? What does he say? What's the content? 3 things he tells him. Verse 3.
To return.
Yeah.
Go home.
To your relatives.
He would be with them.
Yeah, okay. So return to a specific place, and I'll be with you, right? So the first is a command. Go back, okay? The second is a specific destination to the land of your fathers, right? And the third one is a renewed promise, right? I will be with you, right? So before he even sets out, God gives him both directive, a target, and a reassurance. Now that's a pretty wonderful confirmation, right? That's a wonderful confirmation in the process. So with this, Jacob seeks buy-in from the gals, okay? So I'm going to read verses 4 to 9. Yeah, smart guy. Who's going to read? 4 to 9. Verses 4 through 9.
So Jacob sent word to Rachel and Leah to come out to the fields where his flocks were. He said to them, I see that your father's attitude towards me is not what it has been before, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I have worked for your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me by changing my wages 10 times. However, God has not allowed him to harm me. If he said the speckled ones will be your wages, then all the flocks gave birth to speckled young. And if he said the streaked ones will be your wages, then all the flocks bore streaked young. So God has taken away your father's livestock and has given them to me.
Okay, pretty interesting process. Now, this is a bit odd. Why do you think Jacob seeks the opinion of his wives? Other than being a wise man.
Well, they know their father.
Mm-hmm.
They know his moods and his intentions.
Yeah, I think that's a good answer. Okay, so I think he expects trouble and he wants solidarity, right? And I think he's also displaying growth, finally, in family leadership at this point. They do know their father, and we'll kind of see that as he makes his case here for why they should be leaving. Now, his argument for leaving is comprised of 3 points, okay? He makes 3 points. So what are the 3 points about why he's leaving? What are his 3 arguments to the wives?
Laban's unfavorable move toward him.
Okay, so Laban's cheated me. He's unfair, right?
HR reasons.
HR?
He's changed my wages 10 times.
Oh, okay, HR. Right. Does that happen in your company, Larry? You were a little quick on that one there. Yeah.
Someone gave me decaf.
Larry, I loved it.
Oh, okay. Jumped a little quick on that one. I'm concerned. All right, so yeah, all right. Change the wages, right? He's changed them. What else? What are his other arguments?
He served them.
What's that?
He served
them. I served him faithfully, right? And he's tried to cheat me. What else? Yeah, God's blessed him, okay?
In spite of Laban,
exactly right, okay? So, kind of phrase it this way. Your father is against me, but my father is with me. Verse 5, okay? Look what he says. He said, and said to them, I see your father's attitude that is not friendly toward me formerly, but what? The God of my father has been with me. So he's repeating what has been promised and what he's experienced. The next one is that your father has cheated me, but my father has protected me, right? So Jacob's faithful service was abused by Laban, yet God kept him as he promised. Remember back in 28, one of the promises that I will keep you and protect you. 10 times he has changed my wages. Now, we don't ever really see the 10 times. This is kind of a full number, and basically it's an axiomatic way of saying repeatedly or time after time. Time and again, he's changed the deal on me, okay? And he's kind of stating that in an emphatic, idiomatic type of way. The final one is that your father decreased while my father has increased me or blessed me, right? So we really get in verses 8 to 9, right, the answer to their spurious claim, right? He's taken it away. No, God's taken it away from your father, and he has given it to me. So it's a different Hebrew word, but it's very emphatic. God has caused Laban's flock to be snatched away and given to Jacob in the process. Okay, so kind of 3 basic arguments that he makes to his wives. Also note that God's care for Jacob kept pace with Laban's ever-changing terms. Laban said spotted, right? And God gave spotted. He changed to striped. God changed to striped. Okay, so you're not going to outbox God, right? But he had to learn that in the process. So before the wives reply in verse 14, okay, because that's where we get the reply we have this very interesting little soliloquy in verses 10 to 13, okay? So what's going on in 10 to 13? What's going on?
He's given an explanation as to what has taken place. You know, yeah. Where they came from.
Right. So who's giving an explanation?
Jacob.
Well, no. Who's?
Well, the right
God. Who gave it to Jacob?
God.
Yeah, right. So God's giving Jacob an explanation of how this happened, right? Because they know the general genetics, right? They don't know it like that silly little chart I gave you last week, okay? But they can look at it observationally and realize that you're not going to get a predominance of these kinds of animals coming from these ones. So what we're going to get here is a parenthetical pause. Yeah?
Okay. Go ahead. When he says this, I lived at the time... You know, I looked it on my eyes and saw a dream, but isn't he relating the dream to his wives?
Yeah, no. Yeah, in that context, you're right. No question about that. He's relating something he saw.
Right,
what he is relating is a revelation that he got for God.
Yes.
So he's getting an explanation, and he's now pausing to share the explanation, okay? So it's parenthetical. Right, and here's why I can argue that. So if I read verse 9, thus God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me. Verse 14, Rachel and Leah said to him, do we still have any portion? So it's very logical. You can jump right to 14, and it makes sense in terms of following the process. So it's kind of a pause, and it's Doug's right to say that he's relating, okay, a revelation that he got that's explaining this point in verse 8. How is it that every time Laban changed the rules, somehow the output changed to match the changed rules, okay? And so in verses 10 to 13, we're getting an explanation of how and why that happened. Do you have a question or just flexing? No? And Jack, okay, I thought I saw a hand. All right, so it's parenthetical. It's a supernatural revelation given by God to Jacob in the form of a dream. It's perhaps a continuation of the dream that we got in summary in verse 3. There's some connective words, but we don't have to go too far there. And the revelation is the biology lesson for Jacob, right? And the biology lesson is simply this, namely, while they're homogeneous on the outside, meaning what he can see, they're all solid colored, they are heterogeneous, dominant recessive genes, remember we went through that last week, on the inside. They carry the recessive genes to produce the striped, speckled, and spotted offspring. Okay, so he's giving Jacob a bit of a biology lesson that says, well, it looks like it's this way, okay, the possibility of your having these kind of offspring does exist inside of those animals. So somebody read verses 10 to 13 for me. Somebody who hasn't read yet.
And it happened at the time when the flock Then the angel of God spoke to me in a dream, saying, Jacob, and I said, here I am. And he said, lift your eyes now and see. All the rams which leap on the flock are streaked, speckled, and gray-spotted, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land, and return to the land of your family.
Okay, so the verses are a reassurance to Jacob that God was in control and the ultimate outcome was regulated by God's providence. Now, the bottom line is this. God was going to bring about what was genetically possible in miraculously excessive proportion, right? Because how did his flocks get so big? Well, he had to beat the odds. You know, the basic genetic odds were 25% were going to come out that way, but obviously they went the other way. Yeah, Roger.
I'm going to say that it wasn't odds. I think God was doing it purposely.
Oh, sure.
There's no odds in God.
Yeah, of course. Right. And that's kind of the turn of the phrase, and you're correct to note that proper scenario. Based upon what science tells us and the genetic probability, it would have been 25%. But as you correctly note, because God's in charge, it's going to be whatever percent he decides. Okay? So the fact of the matter is that he doesn't allow the normal laws of nature. It is a miracle. Okay, it is a miracle. simply that, right? And we see it. I mean, you see that in nature as well, where they, you know, the, what you would expect is not happen, but clearly God's providentially controlling that. Reminding us that while the Bible is not a science book, right, it is accurate when it speaks of scientific matters, right? It does do that. Now, how does the section conclude in verse 13? What's the conclusion here? Yeah, get up and go. Absolutely right, right? So he reminds him that he's the God of Bethel, right? Now, the God of Bethel, what would that have brought back to Jacob's mind? Well, Jacob's ladder, that big event back there, right? That happened at Bethel, which he named it. So definitive affirmation of who's speaking to Jacob. And then this threefold command. So in case he was confused, these are three imperatives, right? Get up, go forth, go back. Okay? He's pretty clear that it's time to go. So God goes through the process, okay? And so the final imperative. Now, verses 14 to 16.
And Rachel and Leah answered and said unto him, is there yet any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not counted of him strangers? For he hath sold us and hath quite devoured also all our money. For all the riches which God hath taken from our father, that is ours, and our children's. Now then, whatsoever God has said unto thee, do.
Okay. So, we have their response now. So, picking up from verse 9, Rachel and Leah respond in the affirmative to his case to leave. They all decide to stand united as a family and with a little speech of their own. So, what are their reasons for siding with Jacob? Why do they agree?
They don't have anything.
They got nothing with Daddy. We'll go with him. That's exactly right. So they're kind of two pragmatic assessments with a little spirituality thrown in. Okay? So the pragmatic things was they too felt the same disregard from their father, right, as Jacob felt from his years of service. Their father had used them as a negotiating pawns to serve his selfish desires. I mean, he didn't have any regard, which is going to make kind of his little speech in the next section a kind of silly. I couldn't kiss my children and grandchildren when they left. Right? So leaving them with no inheritance or future in Haran. So even though the women had few rights, his disregard for his daughters was excessive. Yeah.
It's just an observation of Jacob. You see over his life 20 years of submission to Laban. And I mean in the character that he displayed and through that. And simply waiting upon the Lord, whether he realized it or not, he wasn't going to move until he got the shoehorn, or he got pried out. I mean,
right.
I just see the faithfulness of God by a man who grows and who develops. And so, when Laban approaches him later on, I mean, he's able to stand up and relate just exactly what he had eaten all that for 20 years.
Right.
You know, he said, but God had I stayed in the cold. I slept outside.
Yeah.
But God protected me.
Exactly right. And we'll pull that precise point out when we get to that part. Yeah, Ken.
I see a really personal, powerful application back in verse 13.
Yeah.
When he's having his dream, and in the dream, God says, I see all that Laban has been doing to you.
Mm-hmm.
And how powerful that is for us today to realize that no matter what we're going through, God sees how much more so with the Holy Spirit in our heart speaking to us when mush of life hits us. God says, I see what you're going through right now. I may not answer you right away, but when you want it, I know what you're going through.
No, I agree. I think that's a powerful thing, and there's really kind of two parts to that, right? The good part is that he sees, so if you're doing something he doesn't want you to do, he sees, right? You can't get away from that. But the other part of it is he does see. You're not out there on your own. He may not change the circumstance, as you note.
It's a caring attitude that we see every day in our walk with the Lord.
Right.
He really does, as we heard this morning, loves us intently.
Right. And the idea, though, is we have to think about that even in the context of bad events in our life. Right? So he sees good and bad in our life. Right? So when we're going through something difficult, we still have to recognize it as good, right? Which is why James tells us to do what? Count it all
joy.
Joy to the world. No, I don't count it all joy all the time when I'm getting smacked around. I don't like it. But the fact is, that's what God says. Be joyous about the fact, because I see, and I'm doing something in your life, while you're going through it. So good point, Ken, and also Doug, for you as well. So we see that as we go through that whole thing. So they view themselves as strangers in their own home because they've been reckoned as foreigners by their father Laban. So therefore, they consider Jacob's prosperity as their rightful due, and they bid Jacob to do as he has been instructed. So that's kind of the spirituality thrown in. Do as your God says. So it's kind of, they're not yet owning it as their God, so we see some of the syncretism, and we will as we keep going. Okay, verses 17 to 21.
Then Jacob arose and put his children and his wives upon camels. And he drove away all his livestock and all his property which he had gathered. His acquired livestock which he had gathered in Padan to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. When Laban had gone to shear his flock, then Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's. And Jacob the sea left in the Aramean by not telling him that he was fleeing. So he fled with all he had that he had, and he arose and crossed the Euphrates River and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead.
Okay, so the caravan departs, right? So upon his wife's buy-in, he musters the caravan, he sets out. Must have been quite a feat. He's got a lot of stuff. He's got a lot of servants, so he's probably staging this whole process. And except for two things, right? Everything's good. And we don't get a lot of detail, but we get details about two things. What are the two details we get in this section? Yeah, so Rachel takes the gods. Yeah, she went shopping. Yeah, she went shopping in Pop's house, right? So she went shopping, and she took the family idols, which in the text is called teraphim, okay? So she took those. And what else? She stole the household idols, the teraphim. What else was stolen?
He stole away.
Yeah, he stole away. Okay, you're right. You're not going to get it from the text, because it always translates it in most of the English versions as the word deceived. Now, I don't like it. It's not a good translation. Literally, it says he stole the heart of Laban. Okay, that's what the actual Hebrew says. Okay, so interesting play on the same Hebrew word. So she stole the family gods. He stole Laban's heart. I mean, he just sucked the heart out of him, basically, is the idea. So interesting play on the words, which most English translations do is deceived. Okay. What's that?
I can see what you're saying. In that he told him not is how they, that's where he stole his heart.
Yeah. The reason I don't like deceived is because, well, we'll get to the second. So he stole everything Laban loved. Okay, so what do you think of Jacob's departure? Should he have informed Laban?
No.
Bobby?
When he's trying to do stuff before, he's always got talked into something where it benefited Laban and not himself.
Right.
After all Laban did, it kind of came back to bite him because he didn't get to say goodbye to his daughters and his grandkids.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah, I think there's a good lesson in that, right? You can think you're getting your way, but you're going to pay for it at some point in time. Yeah, but, should he have informed Laban, do you think? Roger.
No, God didn't tell him to.
Yeah, see, I like that answer.
Yeah,
okay? It seems like nitpicking to me, but I got to tell you, all the commentators just jump all over this deception. I don't buy that. Okay, what did God say? Okay, gave him three commands. Get up, get out, get going. Right? God told him pretty clearly what to do. So I think it's kind of gratuitous, right? Gratuitous 2020 hindsight, right? He's following orders. He's doing what he told, yeah.
Okay, well, let's jump ahead into the New Testament.
Right.
He just said, follow me. They didn't go back. They didn't say anything. They just went. The word of the Lord, they went. And he said, any man who puts his hand to the plow comes back.
Yeah, exactly right.
If there's any Laban comparison.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good example. I mean, follow me, and then
Mary and Joseph did not say goodbye to Herod before they left.
Yeah, right. Good point. Absolutely right. Yeah. Okay. So again, I think it's just a good example. The commentaries are good, okay, and they're helpful, and there's useful things that I get as I look at these things, but just don't swallow everything they say. That's the point. Yeah, Ken.
There's another point here, too. In verse 3, God says, I will be with you.
Right.
But yet Jacob's still afraid.
Yeah, right.
And so apparently a fear caused him not to go to Laban and say, this is where I'm going to go.
Sure, absolutely.
There's an issue with him not fully trusting that God's
right.
going to lead him back safely, even yeah. when he gets back to Esau.
Right. But fortunately, none of us ever do that, right?
Absolutely not.
We all fully trust God with every
fully
step, right?
Well, yeah. I think if you heard yeah. his voice audible,
yeah,
you would
have. Well, yeah, you would think that that would be good enough.
Yeah.
But yeah, and just he just shows human nature in the process. I mean, we see our nature, right? This is the process, so good thing there. So I think he's primarily following orders. You know, look, you could suggest that he would show his growth by going back to it, and then, hey, he was stronger and he could handle it. But we're going to see that in the next section, okay, as Doug pointed out. I think it's kind of a natural thing. Now, what do we say about Rachel's actions?
Like father, like daughter.
There you go. As they say, the apple don't fall far from the tree, right? So she has the family DNA. She also demonstrates some syncretistic worship, right? Reminding us that it is easy, is it not, to hold on to our former idols, thinking it is innocent enough, okay? When we turn to God, we are simultaneously turning from our past affections, right, prompting me to ask, what are we holding on to? Okay? We are always holding on to something from time to time. You know, it's really, what is the thing? I can just, I go to my journey, I go back to it, and I just think of the things that there's just, I just want to still do that. And it's like, it's not edifying if you do that. Yeah, but I still want to just do that. I mean, I'm doing so good in all these other areas. Can I just do that? Right? No. Right? I remember one time I was talking to Mark about something, and I was asking him, I said, aren't I allowed to have bad days? He looked at me and said, no. Now, Mark's not known for being verbose in these kind of sessions at times. I said, okay, you want to get the tissues out so I can cry? But the fact of the matter is, no, you don't. Right? I mean, God tells us what to do, and he takes us through the process. So you can't hold on to these things. So the second act of the play records Laban's hot pursuit. And like Jacob's flight, his pursuit plays out in stages also, okay? So stage one and stage two is he first gets his posse together, right, 22 to 24, and he sets out after Jacob. In verses 25 to 29, he catches up with Jacob, and the first thing he does is browbeat him, okay? Which is kind of interesting, because God warned him, what? Don't say anything good or bad, which is like, keep your mouth shut. But he can't help himself. He's got to browbeat him just a bit. Then the accusation, right, 30 and 32, well, why did you take my family gods? And then the search, and then finally, Jacob musters a little gumption, right? And he has a kind of releases 20 years of frustration, and what I call this little diatribe in verses 36 to 42. Okay, so we kind of see the progression there. So, verses 22 to 24.
When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, then he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him at a distance of 7 days' journey, and he overtook him in the hill country of Gilead. God came to Laban, the Aramean, in a dream that night and said to him, be careful that you not speak to Jacob, either good or bad.
Okay, so kind of interesting, right? So here we go. Laban learns of Jacob's departure, right? He's 3 days after the caravan set out. He assembles his brothers, his teams, and they go to the hill country of Gilead. Okay, so this is where they are. So up here, which is not on the map, is where they started way back here. Gilead, or Gilead, however you pronounce that, is this whole eastern boundary of the Jordan River. Okay, it's this hill country that spans between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. Okay, so that's how far they've made it, probably up around the river Jabbok, which is right here, which is going to have some of the events. But that's where they are, okay? So he catches up with them after 7 days' journey. And what's interesting about this opening section? What's interesting about it?
God
came to Laban. Yeah, okay. God speaks to Laban. All right. Now he's been speaking to Jacob so far, but now he has a few words for Laban in the process. Yeah, Jack.
It's this, God kind of give Jacob a head start.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And you think about it, right? He needs a little head start. He's got a bunch of kids and a bunch of, you know, nursing lambs and all that kind of stuff. So he's going to need a little head start to kind of get back. But it seems like he still made pretty good time because he's gone a long ways, even by the time he's gotten there in the process. So I guess he's driving the group pretty hard, trying to hot foot it back to what he considers to be safety. Now, what does he tell Laban? I kind of gave you the short answer before. Yeah, don't say a word. Okay, don't say a word. Be careful, Jacob, what you say to him. Hebrew literally says, don't, lest you speak with him from good to bad. Meaning, really, don't say anything, Laban. It's time for you to be quiet and give him a blessing and move on. Now, does Laban heed God's warning?
No,
he just can't help himself. He sort of does. Okay, he sort of does. Take a look, 25 to 29.
Laban caught up with Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen camped in the hill country of Gilead. Then Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done by deceiving me and carrying away my daughters like captives with the sword? Why did you flee secretly and deceive me and did not tell me so that I might have sent you away with joy and with songs, with people and with
all of you,
and did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters? Now you have done foolishly.
One more.
It was in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, be careful not to speak to either good or bad to Jacob."
Now, being the kind of caustic guy I am, I'd have probably said to Laban at this point, "So why are you talking?"
Yes.
Right? But no, Jacob holds his tongue for a while here yet, right? So kind of an interesting scenario, right? So it seems he can't help himself. This interaction, he's kind of browbeating Jacob, I think, right? He's just kind of smacking at him and browbeating. He paints Jacob in the worst possible light. "You're a deceiver who led off his daughters like captives." Now, again, it's the same word, okay? It's he stole the heart of Laban. Okay, so it's not really that. He robbed Laban of the joy of a proper send-off. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Come on, Laban. Yeah. Can you come up with something a little better than that, that we might have some sense of belief? So hypocritically, he bathes himself as grievously wrong, because I would have loved to give you a big party and a send-off and kiss everybody away and give you a blessing. I don't think so. So Laban brings his opening salvo to a close with an assessment of Jacob's actions. What does he say about Jacob's actions? "You're foolish."
Yeah.
Okay, you silly boy. Okay, what are you thinking? That was just foolish. Okay, so switching gears, Laban changes course from browbeating to bluster. Okay, so he blusters a little bit, puffs his chest up in the first part of 29. What does he say? "You know that I can harm you." But then he realizes, "Oh, I'm probably going a little bit too far. You know, God told me to be careful what I say. But your God told me not to touch you." Okay, so what's wise about Jacob's reply to Laban? What's wise about his reply? I already told you. He didn't make one, right? He keeps his mouth shut and he lets Laban blow off steam. Okay, why is he silent? Why do you think he's silent at this point? It's just speculation. There's no... Roger.
Because he knows Laban's wrong.
Yeah, exactly right. He can't say for sure. He likely, and everyone else in earshot, realizes the empty, bombastic harangue, right? He knows Laban's wrong. You know, why? You know, you've heard this, right? What's one of the greatest lessons, you know, in Proverbs? It says, don't escalate, right? You know, respond with a soft tongue. Let the wild guy go and make a fool of himself. And you just reply with softness and gentleness in your process. So, again, I think we're seeing growth in Jacob in the process. We're seeing, yeah, Jim?
I was just going to say, God promised him, "I'll be with you."
Right.
Laban didn't have the power to harm him.
Right.
I told him, Jacob, he's going to be with him. All he had to do was cling to that.
Yep.
Be afraid of him.
Yep, agreed. Right, doesn't have to be. But, you know, in human nature, we kind of have those things. All right, 30 to 32.
"And now you have surely gone because you are greatly wronged for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?" And Jacob answered and said to Laban, "Because I was afraid,
For I said, perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force. With whomever you find your gods, do not let them let him live. In the presence of your brethren, identify that I have of yours and take it with you. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them.
Okay, so now the accusation, right? So Laban switches gears yet again, and he starts out with a face-saving gesture. Oh, yes, you know, I know you just want to get back home to Dad, right? I mean, you're not really leaving me, per se. You just have this longing to be back with your family 20 years later. The face-saving gesture is that, despite his foolish actions, Laban acknowledges the legitimate motive and the longing to return home. Okay, so he does that. Indirectly excusing himself of any culpability, right, for Jacob's leaving. He doesn't say, yeah, you know, I've kind of been a shrew, right? No, nope, none of that in the process. Now, what's the accusation? You stole the gods, okay? You stole my family gods, the teraphim. Now, Jacob speaks up, and what's interesting about his response? What does he respond to first? He said, you've stolen my gods. What does he do in his first reply?
He admits to it.
What's that?
He admits to it.
No, he doesn't admit to it. No, no, just the opposite. He goes back and answers the opening question from 26. Why did you sneak away? I was afraid you're going to keep your daughters, okay? He doesn't even answer the accusation. What does he do? Boom, he goes on the offensive. Okay, so what's noticeably absent in Jacob's reason, though, for why he didn't tell him? What's that? He said he was afraid, but what's absent in his reason? Absolutely right, right? He doesn't say God told him to leave. That would seem to have been the simplest answer, right? God told me to leave, which is really ironic since Jacob or Laban just told Jacob that God had spoken to him. Right? It would seem like a pretty easy answer to give and kind of logical one at that point in time, but yet, I got to give Jacob credit for being honest, right? That was the honest reason. He was afraid, right? He figured, oh man, you've kind of talked me out of it every other time. You're going to take the kids and everything else. Now, why does he go back to the first question? I can't be dogmatic, but I believe it's because he simply dismisses the second question. He just thinks the second question is so utterly ridiculous that he just answers the one question before. So instead, he commands a search to be made of the premises to prove his innocence and declares anyone found with Laban's good will be put to death. And since we're all fans of Scooby-Doo, we say on thing, "Raro, we got trouble now." Okay, "Raro." All right, so kind of reminds you of the rash vow that was made by Jephthah, right? A little later in the story here. But, uh-oh, she has indeed taken the family things. Okay, 33 to 35, we'll finish with this section here, and we'll hold off for the next part. Somebody read that.
So Laban went into Jacob's tent, and into Leah's tent, and into the tent of the two maids, but he did not find them. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household idols and put them in the camel's saddle, and she sat on them. And Laban felt through all the tent, but did not find them. She said to her father, let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of woman is upon me. So he searched, but did not find the household idols.
Okay, so the accusation, the search, is the next part. So Laban himself, it seems, conducts a thorough search of the tent compound, right? So he does it himself, proceeding from Jacob to Leah to the two handmaids, and he finally arrives at Rachel's tent. So the tension is growing, right? Rachel knows what she's done, nobody else. Where he leaves no stone unturned save the camel's saddle upon which Rachel is seated. Now, Rachel is wicked shrewd, right? She doesn't protest the moment he comes in. She lets him kind of do his search, right? Because if she protests too early, she's going to raise suspicion in the process. So she calmly lets him look around. And then when he kind of comes to the saddle area, she asks forgiveness for not getting up. And she gives him a credible answer. So you got to give her credit. She's good, right? But why is she good? She's just like her dad. She learned from the master, right? Okay. So did Rachel lie?
Oh, yeah.
Did she? That's a better answer. We don't know, right? But it was a credible excuse, okay? One that was clearly accepted by her father in that scenario. Was she deceptive?
Yes.
Now we can all say yes, okay? Most assuredly, yes, as we know that a search of the saddle would reveal, proving yet again, right, that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So she is a product of her father and how it works. Now, why do you think that God protects Rachel? Why do you think he protects her? I mean, she's stolen them. She's lying. Not lying. She's deceptive. Why does he protect her?
Because Joseph comes, the... Joseph,
yes.
The Davidic, the line of Christ.
Right, okay. All right, maybe. That's one. But, well, just a simpler answer. Huh?
I think he wouldn't want, Jacob said whoever did this, he would kill him. No, yeah. He would be killed, and I don't think he wants Jacob to.
Okay, so I think she's on the right track. It's kind of a trick question. I don't think he was protecting Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was protecting Jacob. Okay, because this was the wife that he loved. Yes, the Davidic line or the messianic line is going to come there, but God worked through her misrepresentations to protect Jacob in the process, because imagine how Jacob would have responded if he'd really seen that process, okay? So we're already out of time, so we will come back to the diatribe. We'll pick it up there next week. Finally, after all this, okay, Jacob is going to explode, and he's going to give Laban a piece of his mind, and that's where we'll start and pick it up next week.